As I mentioned, my real goal for today is to allow listeners to actually know what Cinco de Mayo is, whether they are celebrating it or not. And I have with me on the line someone who can really teach us a lot about it. You know, if you don't know anything at this point, if you think it's Mexican Independence Day, so be it, because we're going to be educated a little bit here by Margarita Sanchez, who is the professor and chair at Wagner University in Staten Island of the Modern Languages, Literatures, and Cultures Department. Professor Sanchez, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, why don't we assume that someone just came off a UFO and has no idea what Cinco de Mayo is, other than maybe, you know, St. Patrick's Day with better weather and slightly different flags. Tell us about the basics of Cinco de Mayo.
Okay. I think that first of all, I will take the opportunity to talk about the context of today, because in 2017, we have to talk about Mexicans in a different way. Cinco de Mayo symbolizes somehow the situation that Mexicans are confronting today, trying to define their identity against stereotypes.
Sure.
Cinco de Mayo has nothing to do with the independence of Mexico, except that it happened in the same century. So I will try to explain in in a few minutes.
Take your time. I'm not rushing you here.
Right.
I want people to learn. It's good. It was, 155 years ago today, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, just make sure I have it right.
So we are in 1962, and Mexico had been going through big crisis in the 20s. It was the independence of Mexico from Spain. In the 40s, as some of you might know, Mexico also had the war against the United States, when Mexico lost a big part of its territory. And after that, they were going through a civil war. And the civil war was between two main parties, the conservatives and the liberals. And after 3 years of civil war, the liberals won power. And in 1961, Benito Juarez, who was the first president of indigenous roots, was elected as the president of Mexico. At that time, the foreign debt was huge, was humongous, and Mexico was not able to pay for the foreign debt.
They actually come to a settlement with England and Spain with the debt? So
yes,
it was
they
just
did.
France that they didn't.
Well, yes. But initially, the three powers got together and came to Mexico, to Veracruz, Spain, England, and France. But then they came to an accord which was called La Soledad, and England and Spain returned to their countries. But France clearly had different plans.
And by the way, I just want to emphasize, it's not exactly the first time in history that a country was in a war situation and then couldn't fully pay back the bankers. Read The Creature from Jekyll Island if you want to know more about that. But I didn't mean to take you off track, but certainly it's not unprecedented.
Okay.
Bankers like wars for a reason. Okay, go on.
Right.
Sorry.
Right, exactly. So they, Mexico promised to pay the debt, but as I mentioned, France had different plans, and the forces stayed. Also, they sent a big troop to Mexico, while Spain and England had sent fewer men. The army was much bigger in the French case.
Mm-hmm.
So the general Ignacio Zaragoza in Mexico organized the troops in Mexico, and he was the main figure of this battle, and was able to put together a good plan and got troops from different parts of Mexico, of the whole country. Although conservatives were, some of them were planning to be on the French side.
Mm-hmm.
But his message was, we are going, we're battling against the first army of the world, but you are the children of Mexico, and you're going to defend your identity against a big power. And the French were not prepared. They thought that the Mexicans were going to surrender,
uh-huh.
and was not prepared to see peasants from the highlands of Puebla coming with their machetes to fight against them.
And let me just point out, Puebla is southeast a little bit from Mexico City. I think I have the geography
exactly.
right there.
Well, the French were planning to go to Mexico City, but to go to Mexico City, they had to go through Puebla. And in Puebla, there were two main forts, Guadalupe and Hidalgo. Hidalgo, where the troops of Mexico, the Army of Mexico, organized and were protected against the French forces. So that morning, I think it was 12 at midday, they started to attack. They reorganized, but they lost uh-huh. that battle, and that was a big victory for Mexico. And
it was a rout,
for the
right?
nation.
I mean, the French lost five times as many people. I mean, they clearly underestimated the Mexican capabilities, is my understanding.
Completely.
And what I found was interesting, I think it was through reading your stuff, that much of the celebration, the origin of the celebratory part of Cinco de Mayo, was from Mexicans in America near San Francisco who were gold miners. I had no idea about that.
Yes, completely. And there is a big population of poblanos, both on the east and the west coast. So it is the identity of poblanos here is big compared to other parts of Mexico. So I think it's the identity of poblanos.
That's interesting.
Yes.
You know, when I think about the misconceptions about Mexico, I think there are a lot of misconceptions out there about Mexico and Mexicans. One is about the weather. People think it's really hot because it's so south of here. They forget, as the French military found out, that there's a lot
right.
of hills and mountains, and it makes it cooler and also makes them at a strategic disadvantage, as you were saying. But people just assume Mexicans are all the same, that you know, they forget how diverse and geographically diverse is, and the immigration patterns is. Pueblanos may go to a certain area. The Mexicans who are a big part of the Californian population are from a different part of Mexico as those who go to Texas, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think people don't really, I mean, you can tell more. I'm not an expert on it by any means, but it's just.
I mean, my expertise comes mostly from my role as a community member rather uh-huh. than as academic, because I do work with an organization in Staten Island that works with undocumented Mexican workers. And
uh-huh.
I have been doing a lot of research about transnational projects, and I have been traveling to Mexico, and we have been able to reunify families, immigrant families that have been separated for years. So I do have a strong passion for
sure.
for Mexicans, and I've been working with them a lot, and I've learned about their different traditions, and I've learned about the different languages that they speak, and as you mentioned, I have learned about all of these differences in cultures, in geographies, in styles of living, in food, etc.
Let me ask a question. And I think I pointed out in the intro that you're actually not of Mexican background, you're of Colombian background. Maybe we'll get to that. But I'm curious, it's pretty obvious why, if you're in California, Arizona, New Mexico, or Texas, why you'd have certain populations from certain parts of Mexico there. But I'm curious, in
mm-hmm.
other cities with a large Mexican population, Chicago, New York, Denver, for example, are there big regional differences in where the Mexicans come from within Mexico, or is it pretty much a cross-section when you go a little further from the border?
Yeah, I mean, I know mostly about the communities of Mexicans
mm-hmm.
that are located in places like Staten Island or Brooklyn. Many of them, as I mentioned, come from the Puebla region.
Oh, okay.
And so it happens that, you know, just like many different immigrant groups, the first ones come and establish the roots somewhere, and then they start bringing their families and community
Right.
members, and it becomes an attractive territory for them to start families, to remain and create their own business and their own ways of living.
And that's true of a lot of immigrant populations. For example, Jews, you know, would go where they had a cousin. They would maybe go to
Exactly.
Baltimore as opposed to New York because they had a cousin who had a job. And I'm sure that's true for all kinds of immigrants. But I'm just curious. And it's not for any particular reason other than, hey, that's where my relatives were. That's where my friends were.
Exactly.
I knew them, and that's where I got a job.
Exactly.
I'm trying to think, what has there been growth in Cinco de Mayo in recent decades as opposed to, say, 30, 40 years ago? I just don't remember. Obviously, I was too young to get into a bar, and there weren't too many Mexican-Americans where I was from in Pennsylvania. But it seems like it's been growing. That may well be because it makes a lot of money for bars. But, I mean, is there
right.
anything you've observed, or the bars just want to get in on it, like St. Patrick's Day?
I think it's mostly, I mean, for many Americans, it's just mostly a day in which they can drink Coronas and Tecates and eat nachos more than anything else. I mean, it is true that there are many experts and media channels that are more interested in learning about the real history of Cinco de Mayo. But in the general population, I don't sense a desire to learn about the real history of Cinco
yeah.
de Mayo.
Well, I'm trying to help that. People are welcome to go
right.
after they listen to the show and go to the bar and have as many drinks. there is a question I have to get ask you about. I'm sorry. We have
right.
some rapport now that we've been doing this for 10 minutes. Again, I'm talking to Margarita Sanchez, who is at Wagner in Staten Island. She's the professor and chair of the Modern Languages and Literature and Cultures Department. Okay, I have to ask you this question. Does it get annoying after a while having the first name Margarita today?
Well, I just, you know, I usually, you know, when I'm trying to teach the pronunciation of my name, I usually use it and I tell them, just like the drink, it's Margarita, just like the drink.
Sure. Well, I'm sure a lot of those are being consumed today.
Exactly.
You know, I've only been to Mexico once in recent years. I happened to be in El Paso, and on a Saturday night, I went with a friend. I said,
mm-hmm.
let's go across the border, and we went to Ciudad Juarez, and
right.
we went to the Kentucky Club, and that's actually the birthplace of the margarita, and it's just
wow.
it's funny how they make such a big deal of it. You know the story about that, by the way?
I don't. Why don't you share it with us?
You may be disappointed about why it is called the margarita, but there was apparently a woman many years ago who was just there and having drinks, as people do at bars, and
mm-hmm.
she basically said, make me whatever. What do you have back there that you're trying to get rid of? And he put together lime and salt and tequila, et cetera. And she said, what's this called? He said, what's your name? Margarita. That is how
oh.
it got its name, supposedly. And that's at the Kentucky Club right across the border in Ciudad Juarez.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
And by the way, I was reprimanded for having Tecate. People were saying, oh, there are much better Mexican beers than that.
Yes.
I learned that when I was over there. Oh, you say that in a second. So, okay. You know, you're going to have one drink in Mexico, you're having a Tecate? Just thought I'd pass that on. What are some other interesting things, if I still have people's attention right now, it
yeah.
doesn't necessarily have to be about Cinco de Mayo, but Mexican history, just some fascinating things that people who are paying attention to Mexico and then won't the other 364 days of the year might learn from
mm-hmm.
you in these last couple minutes.
Well, I think we're very close to Mexico, and whether we want to admit it or not, we're very dependent on Mexico in many different ways. You know, we would not imagine our lives without avocados, aguacates, or without some of the products.
Wait, what was the second thing you said? Avocados or what?
I just said it in Spanish, aguacates.
Oh, okay,
avocados
got it.
Is aguacates in Spanish. You know, like all of these things that are provided by Mexicans in the United States. I mean, the whole agricultural work.
Yes.
So, and
Wait, actually, you have something I want to bring up. Two things there. You just provoked two thoughts in me.
Yes.
By the way, I grew up, I don't remember any avocados growing up. I think they've become much more readily available in recent decades than when I was a child. Maybe my parents didn't buy them or didn't like them, but it seems like you see a lot more avocados in grocery stores now. And yes, certainly due to Mexican workers and agriculture, but has that changed? Like certain fruits become more shippable?
I'm not sure about that. I know that it depends also on the demand of the public, and I think that precisely because of the Mexican influence, we are more into guacamole and into certain things that are part of our daily diet. You go to a restaurant and avocados are in salads, avocados accompany a lot of different dishes. And I guess, you know, like for certain products, avocados, when they chip them, they're green and hard, so they're easier to chip and transport to the United States.
Yeah, that's a lot of
other, versus other fruits that are more delicate, for example.
Yeah, people forget how many great tropical fruits there are that they're not eating. I mean, the banana is the greatest fruit for the shipping purposes. It works so well. It takes a while to ripen. You can pack them in easily. But there's so many delicious ones that are just not economically feasible. And that reminds me of another thing you alluded to before, the importance of Mexican workers. Yes, we had a presidential election in which things were put very simply. And, you know, we all know about that. But I had an interesting conversation for a video I did a few months ago. There's a great place where they can grow tropical fruit in the very southern tip of Florida called Robert Is Here. And, you know, it's very agricultural when you go a little bit south of Miami before you get to the Keys. And he laughs at the idea, and he's not a political liberal or anything, the idea that this stuff could happen without the Mexican workers there. You know, and just how important, he said, you're kidding. You just can't get done if American kids don't want to do this. I mean, I don't mean to generalize, but just, no, you got to be kidding if you think you're going to, if you think everyone's legally here and that this industry could even exist without undocumented workers.
Completely. I mean, I think, you know, just not so long ago, when they had, not on May 1st, but a few months ago, there was a strike of undocumented workers who didn't go to work. And many of us, I mean, on that day, just by chance, I happened to go to a restaurant and the waitress said, I'm really sorry, your food is not going to be the same because we don't have some of the Mexican workers that we usually have in the kitchen. So there are certain products that we don't have today, and we're short on waitress. And so it affects the daily lives of every person in the United States. And if we let this progress and get worse, then we're just going to have to go through the consequences in our daily lives.
Yeah, when I dealt with Robert, the owner of the company, he just said, oh, you got to be kidding. Of course.
Yes, completely.
You can't exist without them. And you know what? You made me think of another thing. A book I'm reading right now, it's a famous one. I know it might not be in what you handle as a professor, but it's a famous one. Maybe you've read it. Maybe you are prepared to talk about it. But I'm really loving reading it. And I read it when I was much younger and couldn't appreciate it. The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck.
I read it when I was very young.
Okay, so you're not in a position to talk about it. I'm just really
enjoying
reading it right now. And those are jobs that in the book were taken by what they called disparagingly Okies, people from Oklahoma who had been hurt by the Dust Bowl. And obviously those jobs in more recent decades were largely filled by Mexican workers. I don't know. So I took you off track. I have a couple more minutes with you here. Okay, could you just share a few more things about Mexican history or Mexican culture that people simply might not be aware of?
Well, Mexico, I think, is one of the richest cultural traditions in Central and South America. That's probably why I feel so attached to it. The whole culture of the Aztecs and the Mayans. And even today, it's the paradise of many writers. We had, you know, some of the greatest Latin American writers ended their lives in Mexico City. One example being Gabriel García Márquez, for example. It is a center of culture, Mexico City, but also other cities in Mexico that attracts artists, that attracts you know, many different people, politicians, anthropologists, of course, because we have Mexico has the greatest anthropology museum in Central America. It has a rich history. It has one, you know, we are used to eating Mexican food, but we really have no real sense of what Mexican food is. It's one of the most sophisticated cuisines in the world. It has produced some of the greatest artists, writers, etc. I mean, it's difficult to put it in a few in a few words.
I know. Just interesting facts people might.
I mean,
appreciate.
I think that is. I mean, we're so close to it. I just invite people to travel to discover the different cultures of Mexico. It's easy to go. It's cheap to go, and it's a fascinating country.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, Professor Sanchez, and I thank you
thank
for joining
you so
me.
Thank you so much, Adam. Thank you so much for inviting me to this program.
Okay. Happy Cinco de Mayo.